Mighty nice of you to join us here on the Jim Bohannon Show from the Dial Global Radio Networks. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. Well, do you think they're going after nukes? Could be. Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, showcased to the world his country's latest advances in nuclear technology this past day. But do these necessarily mean Iran is closer to building a nuclear bomb? Here's correspondent David Martin.
Iran's president may have impressed his own people by showcasing his country's latest advances in nuclear technology, but experts like David Albright found no new evidence Iran is dramatically closer to building a bomb.
The announcement today certainly is an attempt to show Iranian resolve in the face of international opposition, but they say that every day. And this doesn't really add any credibility to that threat.
Both the fuel rods loaded into a research reactor and the new centrifuges for enriching uranium had already been seen by UN inspectors, and so came as no surprise to U.S. intelligence.
It's what was expected. I mean, but it does show continuing progress that's building toward a capability that if Iran made a decision to build nuclear weapons, it could implement fairly quickly.
Iran says its new centrifuges can enrich uranium three times faster than the current generation of centrifuges.
What is the significance of being able to enrich uranium three times faster?
Instead of 3,000 centrifuges, you just need 1,000.
But U.S. officials say the new centrifuges are still in research and development and not yet enriching uranium, which still leaves Iran dependent on 9,000 of the older centrifuges.
At the same time, Iran says it is now willing to return to talks aimed at limiting its nuclear program. That could be a ploy just to buy time, or it could be a sign Iran is starting to feel the pressure.
Correspondent David Martin, as we examine just what is happening here and what the rest of the world can do about it, as we talk with Chris DeVito, Director of Outreach for the group Iran180.com, and those are the digits, 180. Chris, good evening.
Good evening. Good to be with you.
Good to have you on tonight. Tell us what this group Iran 180 is.
So Iran 180 is a coalition of concerned community organizations here in the United States that are calling for the Iranian regime to change their behavior fundamentally on two issues, on their treatment of their own people, their human rights record, and on their continuing illicit nuclear program.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering the extent to which grassroots groups like this have a great deal of impact on a country which, to say the least, does not exactly feel the pressure of world opinion.
Well, I mean, I think that our impact comes primarily through our ability to raise awareness amongst everyday Americans who might not otherwise be paying attention closely to these issues. And, you know, through the democratic process and through our relationships with elected officials, and, you know, influential individuals within our communities, I think we're able to impress upon people the seriousness of both of these issues as they stand at the moment.
And certainly in terms of making the American public aware, that is an extremely worthwhile goal, because regrettably, there are probably far more Americans who can tell you who came in second on Dancing with the Stars and can even tell you what Iran is doing right now regarding nukes. The report of the past day from David Martin indicated that this was a good deal of show. In other words, talking the talk maybe, but not necessarily walking the walk quite yet. In other words, maybe this was overreaching just how far down the path Iran actually is. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that I would agree with his analysis and his assessment, and I think that, you know, it was somewhat predictable that the kind of bombastic statements that Ahmadinejad has been making over the past 3 or 4 days were unlikely to yield, substantive, you know, developments that would kind of be commensurate with the nature of his representation of them. That doesn't mean that these are not of concern. I think that, you know, any progress that the Iranian regime is making towards a independent nuclear fuel cycle capable of enriching uranium to bomb-grade material is of significant concern both to the United States and to the international community. So it's certainly not a good thing, but it's not exactly the way they portrayed it.
No, indeed. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626 on the Jimbo Hannon Show as we talk with Chris DeVito of the group Iran180.com. Many people have considered the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Iran to be inevitable. I had a guest on my program one time who told me that, and my response was that nuclear proliferation is probably inevitable. The survival of this regime in Tehran is not inevitable. Your thoughts about that?
I'd say that both of those statements, I would disagree with the inevitability of nuclear proliferation. I mean, I think that throughout the history of nuclear weapons as they've existed, for the past, 60 or 70 years, initially there was an anticipation of a massive flood of proliferation in the early years of the existence of these weapons. And, for the better part of the last century, the non-proliferation regime as it existed was able to prevent proliferation on the scale that it was initially anticipated. I do think that there are efforts being taken in the international community as it relates to Iran's nuclear program that at least have the potential of preventing proliferation in this instance. I think that in the past there have been other concerted international efforts to prevent certain countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. I think the most common examples that people cite are, South Africa and Argentina. I think that they are simply historical. There is a historical record that proves that the international community, through concerted action, can alter the calculus of states that have ambitions to acquire these weapons. I would agree with your sentiment and your statement that, the continued existence of this regime is not inevitable. I think if the past year has shown us anything, it's that unpopular and brutal and autocratic or dictatorial regimes that are deeply unpopular with their people, can only manifest an appearance of stability, and that they certainly are not bound to last forever.
No, not bound to last forever. And in the case, this particular case, of course, when you've got a nation which has openly boasted of wiping another country off the face of the earth, it does cross a certain line. India, of course, on the other side of the coin of persuasion, endured well over a decade of pressure and built its nuke. And, of course, at that point, Pakistan decided that it was going to have a nuke as well. So certainly you can persuade countries that maybe they might not want to, but if they want to badly enough, unless you're a country that is extremely dependent on outside things, whatever, food or some vital resource, and I might add some vital resource that affects the government and not just the general populace, but if you are determined to get nuclear weapons and believe that it is the path to international respect, albeit grudging respect, you're pretty much still free to do so. I mean, don't you think?
You're free to attempt it. I think, though, that the fact that you pointed to when countries are particularly dependent upon single resources in terms of their relationships with the rest of the world, there is a extra ability to kind of exert pressure upon them. And that's certainly the case with Iran when it comes to petroleum. This is a country where 80% of their foreign exchange and 60% of government revenue is acquired through the sale of petroleum, both crude oil and refined products, to the rest of the world. I think, that the principal effort that we're seeing on part of the United States and on part of our allies in Europe is to deprive Iran of its ability to trade in its most important asset. And that is an asset that, given the nature of kind of the distribution of power within the Iranian government, you know, the powers that be, whether they're within the, clerical establishment or within the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, are extremely dependent upon the success and international ability to sell their petroleum. And by targeting that, I think, you know, we will be able to hopefully affect the calculus of the regime in a serious way.
More to come. 1-866-50 Jimbo is our number. 1-866-505-4626 with Chris DeVito, who is director of outreach for the group Iran 180. That's Iran180.com. And we'll be back on the Bohannon Show in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. 1-866-50-JIMBO is the number, 1-866-505-4626. As Iran says, it is making advancements in its program to master production of nuclear fuel, although, as we heard earlier in the program, those advances are not necessarily ones that will lead to quicker acquisition of nuclear weapons. Clearly, though, the intent is there. The genie's out of the bottle. We're talking about this with Chris DeVito, Director of Outreach for the group Iran180.org. That's Iran180.org. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. You talk about the effectiveness of sanctions. I've always wondered why the Iranians, which, of course, Iran produces a great deal of petroleum. They do have a problem, apparently, with refined petroleum. But that's hardly a state-of-the-art challenge there. How hard would it be for Iran to simply acquire some refineries, for Pete's sakes, build refineries? I'm sure the Chinese would be more than happy to step in and do that. And then that bit of vulnerability would disappear.
Well, I mean, I think one of the problems is that you've seen kind of chronic underinvestment in the petroleum sector on the part of the Iranians. And I think this is not an uncommon story when it comes to state-controlled oil industries. I mean, national oil companies the world over are not necessarily the best at kind of reinvesting capital in the places where it needs to go. And, you know, the other thing is that refineries are very expensive business. They're entirely capital intensive. And, there's been decades of sanctions on the Iranian regime that have made the kind of necessary investment more difficult than it might be otherwise. You also have, I think, serious reticence on the part of leading international oil companies to do business. And this is even preceding kind of the intense kind of international sanctions that have been placed upon the country.
Why not the Chinese, though? I mean, do the Chinese care that much? I mean, for that matter, why would the Chinese and the Russians not simply break the sanctions, if not overtly, through some private company where there is at least a shred of plausible deniability that the leadership in Moscow or Beijing could wink, wink, nod, nod, say, oh, these wacky capitalists, what are you going to do? They went and sold a refinery to Iran, or they went and sold food to Iran, or what have you. In the past, the sanctions have not always been effective against countries like Iran.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, the Chinese in particular have been involved in several different kind of consortium arrangements when it comes to developing Iran's energy sector. But, you know, again, I think for them, you know, the refining sector, simply just as a matter of focusing on that, is not attractive. It's not a moneymaker for most of these places.
No,
that's not.
But it would eliminate a certain amount of vulnerability. I'm thinking. I don't know that this is purely an economic decision. If Iran is bound and determined to be free from pressure to develop nukes, then you know they might be willing to lose some money on the proposition just to have the refined product.
Yeah. And I mean, this points to the fact that, you know, Iran has, by necessity, you know, and because of the sanctions, turned to kind of self-sufficiency in a lot of spaces that they might otherwise not be. So that's made them somewhat less vulnerable to sanctions than they might be in a different circumstance.
Now, then, as regards the basic question here, we have heard various people on occasion make the statement that the Iranian regime's acquisition of nuclear weapons is unacceptable. And in my dictionary, unacceptable means not acceptable. It means not that we don't really like it, or that would be a darn shame. It means not acceptable, which is to say, whatever it takes, capital W, whatever it takes. Do you think that that is the policy of this government? I know that we keep hearing hints from the administration about everything's on the table, but I'm wondering if, in fact, that is necessarily credible.
I think that the administration has proven a willingness to take steps that have never been taken in the past to really ratchet up pressure on the regime in a very serious way. And I think that to a certain degree, they've also been more effective in creating a sustained international effort in this regard as well. I think that people who are better placed than I take the administration's assertions in this regard very seriously and believe them to be true. I've got no reason to say otherwise. And I think that they've been quite effective in internationalizing this in a way that stands the best chance of ending this confrontation in a diplomatic fashion rather than in a military one.
If it comes to military, is it that unacceptable to you? I would tell you up front that it certainly is to me.
Well, we're not, as an organization, my organization, in the business of taking policy positions on these types of issues. We do believe that the approach that's being taken right now is the appropriate one, and we do think that, military action has to be a last resort, but it has to be on the table.
Okay. Let's assume that Iran does acquire nuclear weapons, that all of the sanctions go for naught, and that ultimately they do. If that happens, or in all honesty, my opinion, when that happens, what should be the reaction of the world then, when they have, that is to say, detonated a nuclear device successfully, but at that stage have not really become a nuclear power, in that they will not have yet dozens of these weapons, but maybe one or two maximum? What then should be the policy of the world if that happens?
Well, it's hard to speak about hypothetical circumstances like that. I think that it would simply have to be a situation in which the United States laid down very clear red lines regarding any usage, that usage by Iran when it came to against any country in the region would result in the destruction of the Iranian state. That's the I think, acceptable policy position for the United States to take in that circumstance. But, again, hypotheticals aren't something that we really could be dealing with here. I think that we're in a situation in which there is, still a hope of a kind of a non-militarized outcome and a non-nuclear Iran in our future.
Sure. Should there be a Syria 180 or a North Korea 180? Are there other countries that should be targeted, such as you've done with Iran?
Well, yes, certainly. I think Iran is not alone in its, abysmal human rights record and its kind of objectionable behavior internationally. I do think that it's important to point out that the current human rights crisis that's occurring in Syria is very much connected to the Iran story as well. Iran has, we think of China and Russia as having provided the diplomatic and political support to the Syrian regime over the past several weeks, but it's important to remember that Iran is providing material support to the regime in Damascus and, in many ways contributing to the deaths of thousands of Syrians seeking a better future for that country. Human rights abuses at home in Iran are exported abroad throughout the region by the
Indeed.
Regime there.
Every bit of pressure can help, and the group Iran180.org is out to do just that, applying pressure to see to it that the world is aware of the threat. And Chris DeVito of their group is our guest. We'll be back. Up in the sky, faster than a speeding credit card, more powerful than an awful lot of other things in this campaign, and able to leap tall poll numbers in a single bound. It's Super PAC. And by golly, there do seem to be a lot of them out there. Emerging from a significant loophole in the campaign finance laws, and there they are everywhere. We're going to be talking about the influence of those tonight on the Republican primary race, on the general election race, with a guest who has won, I am told. He's a former guest on this program, communications expert, T.J. Walker, one of the leading presentation media coaches in the world, founder and president of the firm MediaTrainingWorldwide.com, and the founder of AmericanLP.com. Really? You too, TJ?
Yes, Jim. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. Wow, I know somebody with his own super PAC. That's cool. What do you do at AmericanLP.com?
Well, it is a .org, by the way, because we're not actually a
business. It is an org, okay.
We're trying to communicate to voters the good things about President Obama and the bad things about the Republicans, specifically Mitt Romney, because we do believe he is the biggest threat to President Obama, primarily because we think all the other Republican candidates are crazy and would be easy for Obama to beat. Mitt Romney has many, many flaws, but at least he's not a far-right loony. So that's why we've invested our time and energy telling people about Mitt Romney. We've done about 12 different radio and television ads now that have aired in key primary states and swing states. And we do social media and interviews like this, trying to communicate to voters. And so far, it's been working. Mitt Romney has an unprecedented unpopularity rating now. It's 53% nationwide. It's just...
I know that can your group take full credit for that?
No,
Some of the efforts of Mr. Gingrich and Mr. Santorum might help a little bit, don't you think?
Newt Gingrich gets a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, I would think so. How big is AmericanLP.org? I'm curious.
Well, we are several months old, and we're looking for supporters every day and contributors. We have more of a grassroots approach. We place a number of the ideas for our TV ads on Democratic-leaning blogs like Daily Kos, and we actually have people there vote on what concepts they like, what ads they like. We did a whole series of ads commenting on how plastic and phony Mitt Romney is, and we used the metaphor of actual plastic dolls. So we did a series of ads showing him as a Ken doll, a G.I. Joe, and a Stretch Armstrong, and let people vote just on that. So some of our ads we like.
Well, you're having fun to a certain extent also.
We have fun, but with a very serious point. We're not trying to be comedians, but we do think there is a lot of just absurdity with Mitt Romney, especially, I mean, that happens every day. He's putting his foot in his mouth, this whole comment about being severely conservative. We actually have a radio ad that's going on the air this week on radio in Michigan that just talks about that ad.
Well, I'm sure this will be very instructive to more than a few conservatives out there to note the extent to which liberals, at least in your case, and I think probably more than a few others, would very much like to derail Mr. Romney as the biggest threat to the president's reelection. You know, the president himself had come out against super PACs and has now said that he's going to encourage the use of them. And I'm wondering your thoughts about whether or not, above and beyond the issues of this campaign, as a citizen, is the concept of super PACs a good idea?
I think for most part it's a bad idea. I'm against super PACs. I'm also against war, too, but it doesn't mean I want to get rid of the Defense Department. And you can't have a situation of unilateral disarmament. I will say that in the context of the Republican primary, though, it has had kind of an opposite effect of what a lot of liberals like myself thought, because it's actually made the Republican contest much more open. It's allowed a lot more candidates' voices to surface. I mean, if you didn't have super PACs, you could easily argue that the campaign would have been over a long time ago. Mitt Romney would have just sewn up the nomination. But the fact that Gingrich has had, you know, basically one rich supporter, and Santorum has one rich supporter, and Ron Paul has a whole lot of grassroots supporters who normally wouldn't be supporting a candidate and a major party nominee. It's actually made the Republican primary a much more interesting process, although I do think...
So in a way, you're almost performing a public service from your standpoint.
Well, I know I'm performing a public service, informing people about what's wrong with Mitt Romney, but that's not what the... You know, most of the spending on
Super
PAC so far has been by supporters of Republican candidates.
Yeah. Would you agree that what I said in the beginning, that basically Super PACs exist by going through a loophole in the election law or the campaign finance laws?
Well, I mean, it is the law of the land. You could always say any law you don't like is a loophole, but the Supreme Court decided in two big decisions, not just the Citizens United in 2010, but the Buckley versus Valeo decision in 76. That one said individuals can do what they want spending on a campaign, and the 2010 Citizens United said that corporations and other organizations and entities can spend whatever they want.
Yeah. Because they're essentially individuals in the eyes of the law.
As long as it's not tied in with the campaign.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. The legality is there. But, of course, I recall, as do I'm sure many of us, that the minute that Supreme Court ruling came out, there was a huge hue and cry, especially from liberal groups. Would I be correct in assuming that that you were a part of that?
Yes, I do think it's a bad decision for democracy. But I also think if you actually care about public policy and you care about democracy, it would be unethical to just sit back, sit on your hands, and let people you think who are doing destructive things to democracy control everything. So that's why I'm glad to see that President Obama did the right thing and the ethical thing by saying, look, Democrats have got to support Democratic super PACs.
Let me ask you, if you could write the campaign finance law, it would be strictly up to T.J. Walker and no one else, and you didn't have to worry about political considerations or anything like that, but just write what you thought was the right way to do it. What would that law have?
Well, that's something a lot of smart people have been grappling with for decades. I think that the number one problem with anyone, and I won't dodge the question, I will tell you, the number one problem with all the reforms in the past is it's always put restrictions on money, and it's never dealt with the underlying problem, which is candidates need money in order to communicate their ideas to voters. So until you address the need, which is they need to be able to communicate, you haven't solved the problem. Ideally, there would be some threshold for establishing legitimacy for a candidate and then figuring out a way to give them enough money so they could communicate with voters. But the third thing you need is a way to stop another candidate who just happens to have an awful lot of money or rich friends from drowning out everyone else's message. You could do that by saying, okay, if TJ spends $10 for an ad, and then if he's running against Jim should get $20 for an ad above a certain threshold. So there aren't any easy, simple ways of doing it. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And
Go ahead.
And you also can't fight the natural tendency of any candidate to want to do something to their advantage. I mean, campaigns, by definition, you are trying to outperform your opponent. One way of doing that is raising more money to buy more TV commercials, ideally radio commercials,
absolutely,
as well as billboards and all the rest.
Yeah. The British seem to have a fairly free system of elections, and they have no need for all of this. Of course, they have rather short campaigns, and they still manage to have an orderly process of periodic multi-party secret ballot elections. What could we learn from the British that might maybe minimize some of our excesses?
Well, I'll put on my Mitt Romney hat and attack you for wanting to be European. Well, they do make things short. And I'm not an expert on English democracy, but they do have short campaigns. I don't think they certainly don't allow candidates to run around and raise $20 million for seats in Parliament, so there are heavy, heavy restrictions. But let's also keep in mind, you know, Great Britain has gone through radical changes, far-left socializing industries, far right, with Thatcherism. You can make the case, and our democracy certainly has flaws, but you can make the case that our system provides a more stable system and doesn't allow the far swings to the right and the left, in part because if you're a candidate, you really have to appeal to a lot of different people across the spectrum, and you have to appeal to people with money if you can get in parliament without necessarily doing that.
More to come. Stay with us as we talk to T.J. Walker. He is, again, the founder and president of the firm Media Training Worldwide, and he does an excellent job at that. MediaTrainingWorldwide.com, the website. And also, he has a super PAC, and it's out there nibbling away at the Mitt Romney candidacy. It's AmericanLP.org. More to come on The Bohannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO. We'll be right back. I think it's the Jim Bohannon Show, from what I can tell. And return guest T.J. Walker is with us tonight. He's the founder of AmericanLP.org, Super PAC, and also, of course, founder and president of MediaTrainingWorldwide.com. Let's apply some of your media training skills here in a critique of the four Republican challengers who still survive. Let's start with Mr. Romney on how he does as a communicator.
He's a strange case because he is amazingly articulate and comes across intelligent, rational, forceful, and when you see him next to, say, a Rick Perry, he looks great. But he's never understood what a soundbite is. He's still used to talking like he's in a corporate boardroom where you can put out entire paragraphs and long, complex thoughts. So he's constantly complaining and whining about how the media is quoting him out of context and saying things like, well, I don't really care about the poor, or I like to fire people. And you can complain all day long that he's quoted out of context, but guess what? Every quote is out of context if you're a politician.
Although, of course, the quote about the poor obviously was, I'm not concerned about the poor because of the social safety net. I mean, it was separated by a comma. You know, I mean, some of these were a stretch.
Every quote that you see in any newspaper is out of context. It's out of the context of an entire conversation, an entire interview. And any interview subject will always be able to tell you, well, I prefer this quote over here because that makes me look better. One of the skills of being a politician is you have to learn how to communicate through the art of the soundbite, and part of that means you have to know how to not say things that are going to make you look stupid. And Mitt Romney likes to talk all the time about how he's not a politician and hasn't been in Washington. Well, it shows. He's constantly having to apologize and clarify for these gaffes. And they're always gaffes that paint a particular picture of, as Rush Limbaugh said, Romney is he's fulfilling this idea of the caricature of the out-of-touch rich country club Republican. And all of these statements seem to reaffirm that. So that's really driving up his negatives.
Newt Gingrich.
sick,
I
traitor,
where do you start?
Pathetic. Newt Gingrich is a fantastic communicator when it comes to showing passion and when it comes to attacking. If you want someone to just, you know, rip the skin off of Obama in a debate, then you've got to love Newt Gingrich. The problem with Newt Gingrich is Socrates pointed out, anytime you're speaking, it's a combination of what you're saying, how you're saying, and who you are, your character as a person. And the problem Gingrich has is what people know about his character, they really, really don't like and they don't trust. And the other problem is everything he says is just incredibly negative and nasty. That does work with a certain constituency in the party, but it really rubs independents, moderates, and other non-aligned voters the wrong way. I don't see him winning the nomination.
He has very dulcet-toned comments about immigration.
He is the master at invective, and I give him credit for helping the Republicans after 40 years take over the House by using such forceful strong, emotionally tinged rhetoric. But that's a different skill set from actually being the president for the whole country.
Okay, Rick Santorum.
He's getting better. He tends to still sound like a third-year congressman with, you know, HR this and Senate bill that. He tends to delve into jargon and to go into too much detail. He does have the advantage, though, of seeming like he actually believes something. When Mitt Romney talks about how, you know, awful Obamacare is, it's just not believable, because I actually think Romneycare was a great thing. He really did help ensure more people in the state of Massachusetts than any other state. It really was the model for Obamacare. But when you see Mitt Romney attacking Obamacare, it's just so phony, baloney. At least with Rick Santorum, you know, he talks about how he doesn't like gays, or, you know, doesn't think women should work. I believe him. He sounds very credible, and sounds honest.
And Ron Paul.
Well, Ron Paul comes across as the, you know, crazy uncle down the street who's yelling at kids to get off the lawn. He does have the advantage of coming across really authentic. Like, it would never occur to him to say something just to be popular. I get the sense that he is speaking from true conviction. Now, I happen to think his convictions are crazy, but I do think that he really connects with a core group, and it's in the millions, of hardcore libertarians. Unfortunately, the Republican Party is not a libertarian party, so it's not ever going to help him win the nomination, but it does help him have a large, powerful voice that's growing. He's going to have a lot of delegates by the time the convention rolls around, and he has created a much stronger platform for libertarian ideas in the Republican Party.
More to come with C.J. Walker from MediaTrainingWorldwide.com and his super PAC, AmericanLP.org. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show with T.J. Walker from MediaTrainingWorldwide.com and his super PAC, AmericanLP.org, principally targeting the Mitt Romney candidacy. And who do you think has had the most effective super PAC thus far in this campaign?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. Mitt Romney's super PACs have done a fantastic job of playing whack-a-mole and beating down any Republican who gets close to him. And that's why I still think he has to be looked at as the most likely Republican nominee. So super PACs are great at attacking, because it's just much easier for an outsider to say bad things about someone. And
There have been occasions when super PACs apparently have come out and said things that the candidates weren't too happy about. Allegedly, the super PACs were working in the name of a certain candidate, or at least for the backing of a certain candidate. It seems to me Newt Gingrich had a problem at one point having to disavow something that a super PAC had done in his name. There is that problem, that they can be loose cannons.
Some are more independent than others. I mean, sometimes if it's your former chief of staff, your former campaign manager running one, maybe there are still back channels of communication. Maybe you just really think alike and you don't have to have any nefarious communication. In our case, we truly are independent because I've actually never met President Obama and I don't know anyone on his campaign staff. So in that sense, we are sort of a hybrid version of more of a grassroots super PAC, and we take a lot of our ideas directly from voters and average people. In fact, any of your listeners who want to weigh in on our ads, they can look at all of them at AmericanLP.org, and they can write nasty things if they don't like them, and they can say nice things about the ones they do, but they're all on our homepage in the bottom left side, and they can weigh in on that. That's
fair enough. Ain't America wonderful? All right, T.J. Walker, he's the founder of AmericanLP.org and, of course, MediaTrainingWorldwide.com. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Network. Thank you for joining us on the Jim Bohannon Show from the Dial Global Radio Networks. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and online at jimbotalk.net. Was it something we said? Guess so. Because obviously we, by we I mean those of us in the media, are not necessarily held in great esteem, okay? Not sure how we compare with, let's say, used car salesmen, people who sell crack to grade school kids, or, of course, members of Congress. But nonetheless, not up there with clergy and presidents of Rotary clubs and so on and so forth. The problem there? Well, I don't know. But it certainly is addressed forthrightly in the title of this new book, Why Americans Hate the Media, hate in big, bold, red letters, and How It Matters. It is in paperback from Princeton University Press and written by our guest tonight, John Ladd, assistant professor at Georgetown University. Nice to have you on the program this evening.
Thank you, Jim. Happy to be here.
Thank you for stepping out into the hated media. Is this just a case of wanting to kill the messenger, or is it more than that?
Well, I think there are a number of causes of distrust of the press and not always exactly what people think. The big things people tend to attribute to dislike of the press, think as a cause of dislike of the press, are that the press isn't covering things the way people want, right? People think that the press is biased, and conservatives think the press is biased against them, and that's why they don't like it. Liberals think the press is biased against them sometimes, and they don't like it. Other people think that the press is too sensationalist or isn't accurate for various other reasons, and that's really why people don't trust it. And I think the true answer isn't that journalists used to be virtuous and now they aren't anymore. Rather, the structure that the news industry operates in has changed a lot, right? Both the political structure and the economic structure. And that's what makes a big difference in how people think about the press. So politically, what changed a lot between the 1950s and 1960s and early 1970s is that in those decades, the American political system wasn't very polarized by party, in that the two parties didn't disagree hardly as much about the issues as they do now. As a result, the stakes in elections were less high from a policy perspective, and politicians thus had less incentive to attack independent sources of information as an electoral strategy. And they just disagreed about facts less than they do now, right? So now the parties did not disagree not just about political opinions, but about basic facts, and thus they're of course going to disagree about how those facts should be covered. So politics has changed a lot, and as a result, reporters have to operate in that environment. And that environment means that politicians are attacking them all the time. And one thing I find is that when politicians are attacking the press all the time, that has a big effect on public opinion, right? So the political system has changed a lot. And the other structural thing that is actually not reporters' fault is just the economics of the news industry has changed a lot. Right. In the mid-20th century, when the press was held in very high esteem, there wasn't very much competition in the media industry for several reasons. First, technological. Right. The cable news in its current form hadn't been invented yet, so there was hardly as much television competition, and the internet hadn't been invented, so there wasn't as much internet competition. And talk radio hadn't essentially been invented until the mid-80s, early 90s. And essentially, arguably, talk radio in its current highly political, opinionated form was essentially illegal until the Fairness Doctrine was abolished in the mid-80s. So the economics of the news industry changed, making the news industry much more fragmented. And as the news industry is more fragmented, you have some news media players who are more partisan attacking the press as an institution, right? Attacking the press generally. So, for example, several studies of Rush Limbaugh's program have found that, you know, the media is the second most frequently discussed issue on the show, right? So, and all that is criticism of the quote-unquote media, right? So partisan news sources criticize the media, rightly or wrongly, but they do it very frequently. And in a more diverse media environment, you're going to have a lot of more sensationalist outlets for news because there's a market for that, right? And that's fairly popular. But the things that are popular and get ratings aren't necessarily the types of news that make people respect and trust the media more, right?
So in other words, we have tendencies in programming in the media to elicit the reaction from the public of, boy, I'm going to tune in and see that, and I hate you for it. So, I mean, really, we get viewers and we get listeners, but we lose respect in the process, which I've always, by the way, found remarkable.
Yes, I mean, there's a paradox where the things that get ratings aren't always the things that get trust and respect, yeah.
If you were to go back a century to the period that was known as that of the yellow press, when you had media which arguably puts today's partisanship to shame, was there a similar drop in public support for the media or public trust in the media?
Well, everything indicates that it's not now that's unusual in terms of people distrusting the press. It's really the 50s and 60s and early 70s that were unusual. It was highly unusual that the press was unfragmented, was centralized, and highly respected. There's really no other period in American history where that happened. You point out in the late 1800s, right, in the yellow press, you know, the major tabloids owned by Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst, we didn't have modern opinion polling until the 1930s, so we don't have polls to point to from that time. But if you look at the way popular writers discussed those newspapers and all popular culture, how it referred to those newspapers, there's no indication that they were respected hardly at all.
And yet the papers of the day were purchased at such a clip that a city the size of a New York or a Chicago probably had 7 or 8 dailies. And today, of course, those cities can barely support 2 papers in many cases.
Yes. And part of that is that a lot of the entertainment that people, you know, now get through television or through the internet or other sources, they entirely got through their newspaper. I mean, newspapers would have a lot of things in them in the yellow journalism era, the late 1800s, that aren't in newspapers now. They would have, you know, serialized fiction, short stories. They would have not the sort of short stories that you typically get in the New Yorker or something like that, but, you know, sensationalist, really mass entertainment short stories. Not disparaging the type of short stories you get in the New Yorker, but, you know, there'd be the type of thing in the written form that you find on network news or cable entertainment channels now, and you get news, you know, about sensationalist crime stories or things like that. A lot of the, you know, more sensationalist type of news coverage that you sometimes get on local news programming now, a lot of that would be in your local newspaper then. Local news is quite successful in that the ratings are very high if you look at local news nationwide. ABC used to have that's a slogan probably now 10 or 15 years ago, maybe more, maybe 20 years ago, that more people get their news from ABC News than from any other source. You know, for a while they had that as their corporate slogan.
Yes.
But people often say, and it's usually true, that, you know, now the truth is more people get their news from local news programming than from any other source. And the type of news you often get from that is the type of news that does get ratings, but often focused on crime or entertainment news or that sort of thing, which I find that type of coverage actually makes people's esteem for the press go down.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-50-5-4-6-2-6. As we're talking about a very serious question, why Americans hate the media and how it matters. It's from Princeton University Press in paperback and written by John Ladd. He is, again, a professor at Georgetown University, assistant professor at Georgetown, based in the nation's capital. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4-6-2-6. So we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead, flagellate us. That's okay. We're used to it. We'll be back. Thank you for being with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4-6-2-6. John Ladd, assistant professor at Georgetown University, has written the book Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters in paperback from Princeton University Press. There's a great cartoon that's included in here, a reprint from a New Yorker. And these two guys are sitting at a bar. One says, so is Cameron Diaz really a babe, or is that another thing we've been led to believe by the biased media? There seems no doubt about the fact that almost anything, if it comes from the media, you know, they told me just now that when we heard the nine bells chime from Big Ben that it's 9 o'clock. Can we really believe that? How did it reach the point of such utter distrust? I mean, I can understand if something is a controversial subject, but it seems almost anything. We have the reverse of the Midas touch, it seems. Your thoughts?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that you notice is you talk about the bells or perceptions of anything. One thing you find is, as I mentioned briefly before, right, not just people's opinions differ between the parties, but also among the public, people's perceptions of facts differ. And trust in the media plays a big part in this, right? So political science has documented for a long time that, for example, when George W. Bush was president and people asked in polls, you know, how is the economy doing? Republicans thought things were going better than Democrats did, right? Not just whose fault it is and who you give credit, but actually just the fact. How is the economy doing, right? Republicans thought things were going better because the Republican was president. Democrats thought things were doing worse. If you ask about other just perceptions of how things are going, you know, are we safe from foreign enemies? Other questions like that, you know, is the deficit gone up or down? These sort of questions, Democrats, Republicans differ. And the opposite was happening to when Clinton was president. Right? When Clinton was president, if you asked questions like, how has the deficit gotten better or worse in recent years? Has the economy gotten better or worse in recent years? Then Democrats thought things were going relatively better. Republicans thought things were getting relatively worse. So in recent decades, we've had this polarization in beliefs. And those partisan polarization in beliefs, that partisan polarization in beliefs is more extreme among people who say they distrust the press. So I think it's caused a lot by both proliferation of more sensationalist news outlets as well as proliferation of criticism of the press and political attacks on the press, both from journalists themselves and from politicians and these sort of things, driven by a more polarized party system, right? And then it has this consequence, which is that it exacerbates this polarization in beliefs about basic facts about the country, right? Beyond just opinions, but actually perceptions of how the world's doing, how our country's doing, right? And that has important consequences because when it comes election time, political scientists hope that one way that elections will hold politicians accountable is that when the country's doing well, voters will reward good performance and generally tend to reelect incumbents at a higher rate. And when the country's doing poorly, politicians will be punished for poor performance, right? But to the extent that people actually don't accurately perceive the world as it is anymore, and instead have entirely partisan beliefs, that might lessen people's ability to reward and punish, right? We're not there yet. and retrospection still plays a really important role. What political science calls retrospection, right? Rewarding and punishing based on past performance still plays an important role in whether politicians get reelected or not, right? But increasingly people not being able to accurately perceive how the country is doing, you know, whether it's domestically, the economy, or the deficit, or overseas, our safety from foreign enemies, or these sort of questions, you know, is worrisome.
Yeah. Now, there's a difference then, depending on which political party you follow, is there a there's a difference based on how partisan you see yourself. What are other demographic breakouts on the level of hatred toward the media?
Oh, well, another big effect is just how closely you follow politics. And because in public opinion research, and one thing pollsters find, right, is a big difference between people, often more consequential than their partisanship, is how politically engaged they are, how closely they, because a lot of people follow politics a lot of people, you know, aren't very interested in political news, right? And overall, as you become more politically engaged, you tend to trust the press a little bit less, but the effect is more extreme and almost entirely actually comes from Republicans, when Republicans are more follow the news more and are more exposed to rhetoric, they like the press a lot less. Democrats, as they are exposed to more news, like the press a little bit less, and then really engaged Democrats sometimes like it more. So that,
well,
I mean, that
that's certainly. Yeah. Go ahead.
So that's a big consequence, and at the very extreme, people who really follow the news a lot. Yeah, the parties do diverge, and the Democrats have more positive feelings toward the press than Republicans.
That finding itself, I'm not sure if this is a self-fulfilling prophecy here or what, but it would certainly seem to buttress the views of those who say that the press, that is to say the mainstream media, which has become a multi-syllable epithet in its own right, yeah, is inherently biased toward the liberal side of things. Is that demonstrably true? Have you gone into citing various news stories and the like that would either buttress or attack that assumption?
Well, there have been a number of academic studies that try to sort of quantitatively measure media bias. It's a very tricky thing because there's no one source that will tell you how things should be covered in a way that everybody will agree on. I mean, that's one of the consequences of a more polarized political system, is that the parties themselves disagree about the facts, right? and so the press, all sources are increasingly in a situation where it's impossible to please anyone. it's interesting, though, that the fact that, especially very politically engaged, among the politically engaged, Republicans dislike the press more than Democrats do. This wasn't always the case. So in the era when the press was most widely respected, the 50s and 60s, for example, let's take one poll from 1956.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to have to take a break here, but let's come back and look back at that era, that poll of 1956.
Sure.
With our discussion with Jonathan Ladd, and again, the political science assistant professor at Georgetown University. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Dr. Jonathan Ladd is assistant professor at Georgetown University, the author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. We'll get to that last part of the title in a moment. It's in paperback from Princeton University Press. Isn't it ironic that the media would be getting more and more blame in this day and age when there are fewer and fewer gatekeepers? In other words, the media has less and less to say about what is in fact read and heard and seen.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I like to try to say in the book, actually, is that when you think about it, it sort of makes sense in the sense that in the 50s and 1950s and 1960s, people weren't constantly choosing between the institutional or mainstream press and alternative sources of information, right? So it didn't make sense for anybody to criticize the mainstream press because there was no alternative for people to go to, right? But increasingly now, more conventional sources of news are available, but also alternative sources of news that are more partisan or more sensationalist are available. So more than ever, people regularly choose between conventional institutional sources of news and alternative sources of news. So now what people think of the mainstream or institutional news media is very consequential for how they live their lives, how they learn information. And so thus, it's something people talk about, it's something people have strong opinions about. I mean, one worry I had, and other researchers sometimes suggested this as I was doing this project, they said, well, be careful, we want to be careful that to make sure people actually have an opinion about this now, because does it make sense to ask people about the institutional media anymore? Because it barely exists, right? But in fact, when you ask people about this in polls, everyone has a strong opinion. The typical, you know, don't know rate for a political question on a poll could range from 2% up to 10%, right? If you ask people about the media and whether they trust or distrust the media, you can have a large national poll of 1,000 people, and only one or two people, or sometimes zero people, will have no opinion. So you're talking about, as opposed to 1 or 2 or 3% don't know or 5% don't know rate, you're talking about, you know, 0.1% or 0.2%. Almost everyone has an opinion and has a strong opinion.
Whether they know what they're talking about or not.
Well, I mean, it's not my job to assess whether they're right or not.
No, it isn't. But I don't mean that you can be ill informed and still be right. But the two don't ordinarily go together too well, as you know, every time you grade a test. But I mean, that is true. I mean, that's really taken to its extreme these days. I mean, these days we turn to the op-ed page before we even read the front page. I don't need the facts off the front page. I'm going to go straight to my opinion. I mean, that's the way we are. I don't know that that's a good trend, but it certainly is the current trend.
Well, it's many ways back to the future. We talked a little bit about the 1800s, and if we go talk about the founding fathers and the founding generation, there certainly was no tradition then of some highly respected, centralized, influential press that everyone trusted. Instead, let's take during the Washington administration, all right, all the way back to the 1790s, there were no highly respected large newspapers that everyone read. Instead, competing factions and competing parties sponsored their own heavily partisan papers. The Federalists, who were loyal to Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, and President Washington, sponsored a newspaper called the Gazette of the United States, whose goal was not necessarily to be fair to everyone, but to get out their message of the Washington administration and John Adams' administration. And the opponents, the main opponent was Thomas Jefferson, who ended up running against John Adams in two presidential elections, 1797 and 1800, started all their own papers that, you know, if you look at them, fairly viciously attacked Washington and John Adams.
Washington was accused as being a betrayer of the American Revolution in one publication. Yes. I want to get back to that poll that you were talking about from 1956, but first a call from Larry in Ozark, Alabama, for, Professor Jonathan Ladd, author of the new book and paperback from Princeton University Press, Why America Hates the Media and How It Matters. Hello, Larry.
How you doing today, Jimbo?
Well, sir, thank you.
I think I got some ideas why people hate the media so much. Just two scenarios. When Geraldo went on his, with the military there and was calling in how far out the mortar rounds were hitting, helping them adjust. And when the media runs barricades because they can't read and make Marines do their job and force them to fire upon, and when they go out in places like that with the military, do they pay a fee for all that great security they're getting? I mean, our military is downsizing due to money. Or are they make money off the stories. Do they pay for all that security and housing and all they get by going out there being idiots? I mean...
Well, okay, we'll put you down as undecided, first of all, Larry. But yes, the military does have to pay a fee for going into a war zone, at least in terms of their expenses. They have to pay for their expenses. Now, in terms of, first of all, I would hate for all of us to be judged by Geraldo, and I admit that his giving out of precise locations, which could, of course, thanks to the international media coverage of the day, give real time help to enemy mortars trying to zero in on our troops. That was pretty egregious. Your thoughts, John?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not going to defend that sort of bad behavior by journalists. I think that that's part of a trend in a certain style of journalism becoming more prominent, right? So Geraldo, for example, is a former talk show host, daytime talk show host, and it's part of this phenomenon of, you know, daytime talk shows and entertainment and tabloid stories merging with the news, right? And he's part of that. And this type of reporting, tabloid style reporting in general, does tend to make people's esteem of the press go down. I tend to not think, though, that I don't think human nature changes over time, right? So I don't think that journalists were more inherently virtuous in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I think human nature is pretty constant, but rather the institutions in which they operate have changed a lot, right? So the media as an institution has in many ways merged conventional journalism with tabloid journalism. And so you send talk show hosts out to report a war, and that's because of changes in the news industry between now and what happened in the 50s and 60s, or when we covered previous wars, I think.
More to come. Stay with us. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, as we will continue our discussion here on The Bohannon Show. Thank you for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO. And we're talking again with the author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. And that is Dr. Jonathan Ladd, assistant professor at Georgetown University. Here's Mike in Pittsburgh. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Dr. Jim. How are you? I had the impression I have, and I'm a political animal leaning conservative, just to be on the table with that, but I'm in Pittsburgh. We have two. We have a conservative and a liberal paper. My perception is that when you say, Jim, to look at the headlines or look at the first page and read that before you go to the op-ed, my feeling is the front page is an op-ed. The photos they publish, the bent they have, the news they choose to cover. So my feeling is that a lot of people disrespect the media because they really don't feel that they have a real news bent. They make the news what they want it to be. My question to the guest is, in his research, did he find any evidence of the editorializing being part of the news? I don't know if I'm being clear with that.
No, you're being quite clear. You see editorializing on what's supposed to be neutral territory, the front page. Professor Ladd?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a tricky question to know for sure, partially because no one can agree on exactly how news should be covered on the front page, right? So, and that's one of the consequences of I think people increasingly disagreeing about parties increasingly disagreeing about facts is that we can a lot of people in the country think that their news on each paper isn't accurate and is colored by bias, but they think it's colored by bias in different directions. So we can't agree all on how to fix it. And that's a problem.
That's an interesting point that Professor Ladd makes there, in that I wonder how many people would be maybe somewhat chastened in their feelings of bias if they realized that people on the other side of the spectrum saw a bias going the other way, which in fact is the case in many instances. To Eugene in Petoskey, Michigan, on the Jim Bohannon Show. Hello, Eugene.
Hello. Just a question for your guest, Professor Ladd. Generally conservative radio versus generally, and I use that term advisedly, conservative print and television media being liberal, and possibly a legacy of some old line capital being involved in that. Have you discussed that in your studies?
Well, one thing you do find is that attitudes toward the mainstream press that, you know, many people think are liberal, among people who are really politically engaged, as we discussed a little bit before, Republicans have a more negative view towards the mainstream press than Democrats do. Democrats are a bit more positive. And so that could be an indication that the mainstream press is a little, or is reporting a little closer to what Democrats like and Republicans don't like. Although, an alternative explanation is that Republican political operatives and Democratic politicians and political operatives have different rhetoric about the press, in that the Republican operatives and politicians have been a lot criticizing the mainstream press more strongly and for a longer period of time. And so it's difficult to differentiate what's actually causing people's opinions to change. And if you look in earlier eras, actually, things get a little more complicated. So we had talked a little bit about the public opinion in the 1950s. And right, so now, among the really politically engaged, Democrats like the press more than Republicans do. In the 50s and 60s, supposedly, the high tide of New Deal liberalism and the liberal media establishment, when it was most dominant, then it gets more complicated, because in that era people had very positive feelings toward the press. So 1956, American National Election Study poll, which is a very large academic poll, found that 66% of Americans thought newspapers were fair, and only 27% of them thought newspapers were unfair. So most people thought press coverage was overall fair. And finally, Republicans had more positive feelings toward the press in the 50s than Democrats did. Almost 80% of Republicans thought newspapers were fair, and a little over 60% of Democrats thought newspapers were fair in the 50s. So it's possible then that what's going on really is a different political environment and a different different environment in the news industry that really made those attitudes so different. And what's changed now may be a lot more that than actual bias, right? Because it's entirely possible that the press in the 50s was implicitly biased towards the New Deal establishment and liberal Republicans like Eisenhower. That's totally plausible. But at the time, it didn't stop Republicans from having very positive feelings toward the press in that era.
1-866-50 Jimbo. We go to Sean in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Hello.
Hello, Jim. Good show today. I have a quick question. Why isn't the press able to paint the picture of the truth? For instance, the debt issue. What's the truth about it? Is America on the brink, or is it possible that the Democrats see it right? We can keep spending. I think that's one area that the people are kind of distrusting. So they go out to get the information on their own. And then what does the author have to say about the fact that most of the news has become comes through a lot of comedy shows now. So it could be serious issues. Jay Leno could make a joke about the death, but we laugh about it. But it really never hits us as a reality or something really serious. Thank you.
Well, what happens, of course, in a comedy show is really pretty much outside the province of serious journalism. And while that is per se, I guess, part of the media, but we tend to think of I think the media in this context as being principally the information conveying and analysis portion of the media. What happens on a comedy show is what happens on a comedy show, and pretty much divorced from this this conversation. I suppose that maybe the United States indebtedness would be a good example of a question of emphasis. Certainly, there do seem to be those in this country who think that that our level of indebtedness is not all that big a deal, and others, and you, I will forthrightly admit I'm in the latter group, others who think that it's a terribly big deal and we're seriously endangering ourselves in that regard. Now then, is that per se a media issue? Is the media incorrectly, to the extent that you've examined this, Professor Ladd, is the media incorrectly portraying the various issues and viewpoints of our debt crisis?
Well, we could separate this into analysis and conclusions based on an analysis and opinion, which could be right. I'm not saying that I'm not saying opinions are illegitimate. You know, some opinions are right and some opinions are wrong. But it is true that right now there's a lot of disagreement, as you say, about what to do about the national debt, when to do it, right? How many years out, and how serious a problem it is in our debt to GDP ratio and all those sort of things. And you do get – one thing I will say for the press is that you can find both sides of that argument and assess for yourself, whether you're looking to different partisan media outlets or in the mainstream press just reporting, you know, that debate. Yeah. Now, the factual question is sort of, is the deficit bigger than it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago, right? And that's a factual question.
Everybody agrees that that's been prominently reported. There's been no divergence of opinion on that. More to come. We'll be right back. Good to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show as we talk with John Ladd, the author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. Lance in Galloway, New Jersey. Good evening.
Hi, good evening, Jimbo. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening.
I have two little quick questions. Number one, do you think the population, the current population, has a clue or has totally forgotten what jingoism is in regards to feeling proud about their country by listening and reading in the newspaper? And also, I'd like to know whether or not you found any correlation in regards to the literacy level of the readers during your studies at any peak time within the last 50 years. I'll take my answer off the air, and I thank you for a great conversation. Bye.
Thank you.
Well, I'll take the second question first. I'm not really an expert. I don't have the top of my head sort of the overall literacy levels of the American public over the past 20, 30 years. I do know that, you know, as we discussed in previous centuries of American history, when there were a good deal less of the public, you know, literate, we also had, you know, a diversity of opinion. That's when we had, you know, many newspapers, many of them partisan, and information getting out that way rather than in this conventional institutional press that we had in the mid-20th century. Yeah. I'm not sure if any of that directly has an effect on people's opinions toward the press, really, though.
But do you want, stay over, if you can, into the next hour, and we'll talk some more if you can. Jonathan Ladd, the book Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Network. Thank you for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show from the Dial Global Radio Networks. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626, online at jimbotalk.net. And there were a few more things I wanted to talk about with our guest from the preceding hour, Assistant Professor Jonathan Ladd at Georgetown University. Dr. Ladd has written the book Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters in paperback from Princeton University Press. Now then, this segment on how it matters. I mean, let's face it, we have had periods when we have had intense partisan divide in the media, far more so than today, and the press survived, and the country survived, and we have today some feelings of that nature as well, but the press survives, although, of course, to a certain extent, it is undergoing mammoth changes, to be sure, and those are, I think, more economic changes than they are just simply issues of how much we like or respect the media. So are we talking here about an issue of mattering all that much? Sure, we would all like to be liked and respected, but as long as we keep doing our jobs and keep having jobs, does it matter that much?
Well, I tend to take sort of a middle course on this. I'm not an alarmist, but I also think there are some things to be worried about. So you're right that in previous eras, the press was very fragmented and very distrusted. And in many ways, we're returning to that type of environment and type of relationship, public relationship to the media that we had before. On the other hand, one of the reasons I find that it matters is that people who dislike the press have more partisan beliefs and adjust their beliefs a lot less in response to new information. So they don't update in response to changes in economic conditions. They don't update their beliefs as much. They don't update their beliefs as much in response to new foreign policy events. And a consequence, they're more likely to keep their old beliefs and have partisan and form their beliefs based on their partisanship. Like we talked even earlier about the deficit, and you even find evidence about this among the deficit, in that people's beliefs about the deficit as well as the economy are tainted by their partisanship. When Obama's in office, Republicans tend to think the deficit's worse than Democrats do. When Bush's in office, Democrats think it's worse than Republicans do, et cetera, et cetera. So if we want people to be able to reward and punish the president based on the president's performance, right, so the president has an incentive to keep the country on the right track because the president knows that he'll be rewarded and punished at the polls, we do want, you know, a good portion of the public to be learning accurate information and not completely distrust the press. So we're not at that stage now, but you don't want distrust of the press to get and partisan beliefs to get completely out of control, because at some point you would have a concern that we wouldn't be rewarding and punishing the president based on their behavior in office, and that wouldn't give the president the right incentives to actually, you know, deliver good outcomes for the country. So a good amount of distrust of the press is not necessarily the end of the world, but because it makes people more resistant to new information and more partisan in their beliefs, there could be a point where it could be problematic for rewarding and punishing elected leaders.
Did I too lightly dismiss the connection between public trust and respect and the current media economic difficulties that we see in this country? Or are the two directly related? In other words, are fewer people subscribing to newspapers specifically because of what we've been talking about tonight?
Well, the immediate economic problems that the news industry had in 2008, I don't think we can blame that specifically on distrust of the press. That was brought in by a number of factors. I mean, all businesses were suffering more than they used to because of the fairly severe recession. The news industry was suffering because of an economic change in advertising, right? A lot of advertising was moving away from classifieds and newspapers onto Craigslist, and other advertising was moving to Google Ads and all this these things. And that was a long-term trend that was hurting newspapers, and the recession was just the impetus. The one way that distrust has been affecting it was the long-term trend, which has been gradual over time, which away from most newspapers, which people think of as the mainstream press, and towards more alternative, more partisan sources of news. It's been a driver of that long-term trend. It's a reciprocal relationship. It's both the result and a cause of that snowball effect. As people they don't tune into the new mainstream press, and their talk radio or other source of information cause them to trust the press less, and then they tune into the mainstream press even less, and then the cycle continues. But that's been more of a long-term trend, which made newspapers more vulnerable. And then the tipping point, the thing that pushed them over the edge, was really this severe recession, which wasn't directly, a result or any way of distrust of the press, but it made them vulnerable.
Should those of us in the media who feel that we have a job to do, and aside from the necessity of putting food on the table, should we take comfort in the fact that people of various political persuasions and ideologies dislike what we're doing? In other words, if everybody is somewhat unhappy, I must be doing something right?
People often say that. I'm not sure. if both sides dislike what you're doing, you could be doing something right, or both sides could be disliking what you're doing because you're doing something wrong. I'm not sure that necessarily means you're right. One of the things I argue is that the press as an institution really hasn't been getting better or worse over time in how they cover things. And it's really changes in the political system and changes in the economics of the news industry that have been this big driver. And the mainstream press has been less of a cause of this, and probably changed less than people might imagine.
All right. To Jackie in Watertown, Wisconsin, on the Jim Bohannon Show. Hello, Jackie.
Hello. Professor, this is directed mainly towards the television media.
Uh-huh.
Don't you think that there is a certain plasticity and bread and circus atmosphere that pervades? It doesn't matter whether you listen to Fox News, CNN, MSN, any of the stations. It just seems to pervade everything, and that's one of the reasons why I listen to the radio, and because I don't have to look at these people. I can just listen to ideas.
Well,
interesting thought, and I might add that listening to the radio builds strong bones and healthy teeth 8 ways, Jackie. The fact that I just now made up out of whole cloth. But go ahead, please, Professor Ladd, and give Jackie a serious answer, if you would.
Well, yes, I can't disagree at all in that there's a lot of bread and circus on television news, especially on television cable news. And the reason that happens is that there are people who dislike it, but... some of us may make some of us sad, but a lot of people do tune in to that sort of thing. I mean, one of the things you found in the cable industry since Fox News started in 1996 is that compared to CNN and more conventional style of cable news, Fox innovated really in two distinct ways that didn't have to go together, but they did go together. One was they provide a relatively more conservative take on the news, and we can debate, what was the more accurate way, but they would say that it's the problem with CNN was liberal, right, or something like that. But they were relatively more conservative than CNN. But separately from that, they were also had flashier graphics, more opinion arguments on the air, and generally tried to add more bread and circus. And the other cable news shows haven't, right now, they haven't followed Fox in trying to copy their ideology. But that competitive pressure has led to more bread and circus and trying to make things flashier, cover more, celebrity stories, get their political opinions more flashy and argumentative. And you see that trend among all the cable news shows, and it's because of a competition for ratings. It's because they believe, and the evidence seems plausible, that sort of thing overall gets more viewers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You got it, Jackie. All right. Thank you very much for that. In the summation, I'm just curious, Dr. Ladd, your thoughts about what you think that the media ought to do to the extent that this is, in fact, something that is correctable by the media, that's within their control, and to the extent that they should be concerned about it. If you had the ear of the movers and shakers in the mainstream media, what would you recommend based on your research in the book, Why Americans Hate the Media?
Well, the first thing I would say is that don't blame yourself. the fact that you're much less trusted than your forebearers were is not your fault entirely. Is largely not your fault. But the other thing I would say is that you're probably increasingly going to have to make a choice whether you want to cater to the segment of the public that prefers a more conventional mainstream style of news. And there are people who do prefer that, who continue to like the institutional news media and prefer news in that style. But it's just a small segment of the public. That's the thing. And that may be a small market niche going forward. Or do you want to move toward the niche of providing more partisan or more sensational styles of news, which would be a different market niche? And increasingly, people can choose. And it may be the case that the conventional style news that tries, you know, I don't know if they always succeed, but tries to cover things down the middle, it may be a small niche going forward. The niche seems to be shrinking. But there's reason to think that there will always be some market for that, and you could stick with that and accept that, you know, this is going to be, you're going to cater to this segment of the public that prefers news this way, or you could make a different choice and go in a very different direction, but you may have to choose going forward.
One of those harsh realities there. Great read, by the way, and that's something I would recommend to all of my media colleagues. It's called Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. It's from Princeton University Press and paperback and written by our guest, Dr. Jonathan Ladd, assistant professor at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for joining us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's really been a pleasure.
All righty. More to come, ladies and gentlemen, on the Jimbo Hannon Electric Radio program, inserted weeknightly, straight up your ear canal, and we'll be right back. Well, here we are with this Jimbo Hannon radio program, and we are delighted that you were a part of the thing tonight, thanks to our guest earlier in the program, Chris DeVito. In our first hour, we talked about the group Iran180.org, which is trying to build pressure to apply public opinion pressure on Iran. I question how effective that will be, but certainly the idea. It's a chicken soup solution. It can't hurt. Also, in the first hour of this past evening, T.J. Walker, founder of the Super PAC, AmericanLP.org. T.J. is an unabashed liberal who made it abundantly clear that he's targeting Mitt Romney because he feels Mitt Romney has the best chance of unseating President Obama. Words of wisdom there for liberals and conservatives alike, I would think. And in the past hour plus, Dr. Jonathan Ladd, assistant professor at Georgetown University, author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters, in paperback from Princeton University Press. Very instructive, I think, for all of us who are a part of this particular line of work. Coming up on the Bohannon Show this coming evening, we will be taking a look at the Gingrich candidacy and the presidential race as a whole with a Gingrich surrogate, Congressman Michael Burgess of Texas. Gingrich, of course, is looking ahead to Texas and Georgia as two places where he has to do well, and that's probably quite true. He does in states like that if he is to remain a serious contender for the Republican presidential nomination. JimboTalk.net is our delightful website. We love to have you there, and we thank you for checking out things like Jimbo Near You in in which we find that we spent this past morning visiting Chris Butts at WGOG Radio in Walhalla, South Carolina. That was a good deal of fun. We'll be visiting our friends at WRNR in Martinsburg, West Virginia, on Friday morning, the 9th of March at 9 a.m., in the company of Mark Crayham, who is the chairman of the Radio Television Digital News Association. We'll be talking a bit about that organization and about a Freedom of Information Award that I'm being presented with on March the 15th. And the evening of March the 9th, Friday, for those of you in metropolitan Washington, we are going to be taking part again as a newsreader for the Hexagon Review. And the program starts at Montgomery College on Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring, Maryland at 8 p.m. that evening. Hope you can be there. Go to hexagon.org and grab yourself a ticket. It's always a fun show that they put on. At JimboTalk.net, we have a poll, and we have fun with that poll. We asked you last week what your favorite Super Bowl commercial was this year. And 29% said that it was not one of the ones we picked, but then again, there were so many, that's hardly surprising. 26% said none of the ads really stood out this year, and that's not too surprising either. Of the ads we selected for you to consider, 23% liked Chrysler, It's Halftime in America with Clint Eastwood. 15% picked the Bud Light Rescue Dog Wego, and only 7% liked Honda's Matthew's Day Off, the Matthew Broderick takeoff on Ferris Bueller. This week we're asking you about some unlikely events, but they can happen. They can happen. How unlikely? Well, which of these do you think will happen first? A U.S. habitat colony established on the moon? Or an electromagnetic pulse attack made in the United States? Or the internal combustion engine is no longer used in cars or trucks? Or the U.S. national debt is entirely paid down, or the Chicago Cubs will win the World Series. Well, okay, some of them were not to be taken seriously. But seriously, we'd like your thoughts. And just let us know at JimboTalk.net, and we'll give you the results of how you felt about this coming up on Monday. I would note some of the things that happened post-Valentine's Day. Some interesting things that have taken place out in the world around us. Among other things, a Lexington, Kentucky postman has been fired on charges he tossed the mail into a dumpster. I don't know, could have been junk mail, I suppose. I'm just saying. A London court clerk is in trouble after getting caught watching porn during a rape trial. Keith Martin of Britain obviously has another hobby. At 5'9", he weighs in at 812 pounds to take the title World's Fattest Man. I note that it took 3 weeks, 4 gallons of paint, 6 gallons of glue, 10,000 nails, 5,000 staples, and 5,000 egg cartons. But Stuart Murdoch of Britain has completed his life-size replica of a British Army Challenger 2 tank. So proof that everybody does, in fact, need a hobby, I do believe. We'll offer you some more thoughts coming up. And also going to be talking with a lady by the name of Ruby D in the next half hour. We'll tell you a bit more about her as well. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, and we're delighted to have you with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Weeknights, we're here, by the way, live 10 p.m. till 1 a.m. If your station doesn't carry it during those hours, that's when you need to call in. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannah Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626. If you missed this, wait till next year in Lawrenceville, Georgia, for the annual Valentine's Day free municipal weddings. Yeah, they do that every year. They'll get you hitched for no charge by the head dude there, the municipal judge. On the other side of the Valentine's Day situation, and expected doubling of the daily crowd in Zagreb, Croatia, at the Museum of Broken Relationships. Exhibits range from a garter belt to a broken garden gnome. Lover's spat, maybe. to an artificial leg. That was donated by a British war veteran who fell in love with his physical therapist. It seems the leg outlasted the relationship. What's in a name? In Sydney, Australia, a man changed his name three times in 2 years from Hormis Daniel to Thomas Daniels to Tony Adam to just the initials AHH. Ah, but a judge has now refused his bid to change it again. There seems to be a trend in Britain where beauty salon owner Charlotte Price has changed her name to Pink Sparkly and All Things Nice. That's cute. Daniel Knox Hewson of Britain is now Emperor, Spider-Man, Gandalf, Wolverine, Skywalker, Optimus, Prime, Goku, Sonic, Xavier, Refu, Cloud, Superman, He-Man, Batman, Thrash. That's his whole name, which may not be as bad, but just as long as Kelvin Borbridge, who now goes by Baron, Venom, Balrog, Sabretooth, Vader, Megatron, Vegeta, Robotnik, Magneto, Bison, Sephiroth, Lex Luthor, Skeletor, Joker, Grind. May I call you Venom? If you lose your phone, you're out of luck, but if you're Allison Peterson of Waukee, Iowa, and you lose your iPhone, you use your Find My iPhone app, follow a garbage truck to a landfill, and sort through the garbage till you find it. Now, that's persistence, my friend. That is persistence. Please go to JimboTalk.net, click on our poll. We would like your thoughts about which is going to happen first among these things. A U.S. habitat colony established on the moon, electromagnetic pulse attack made in the U.S., internal combustion engines no longer used in cars or trucks, U.S. national debt entirely paid down, or the Cubs win the World Series. The last Cubs World Series victory, what was that, 1906 or something? 1908 was the last one. That has to change. It just has to change. Let's all root for that one, shall we? When we come back, I'm going to talk to a lady by the name of Ruby D. Fascinating lady, and I think you'll enjoy our chat. We'll be right back. Kind of a nice sound. I like that. And we're going to talk to the lady behind that and a bunch of stuff as well. That is to say, Ruby D of Ruby D and the Snake Handlers. And we're going to talk about the song, which is included in the book, Ruby's Juke Joint Americana Cookbook. Ruby, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And you have had a pretty varied background over the years. And among other things, you quite a talented musician. Tell us a bit about your music career.
Sure. I started out in choir when I was a kid. My grandma was the choir director, and I followed along because that's what I had to do, and I loved it. And always spent time singing on the back porch with whoever was, you know, had a fiddle or a guitar pulled out, and pretty much that I grew up into, it became natural for me to sing with people. So I started singing with people many years ago, and about 10 years ago, put together this band, Ruby D and the Snake Handlers, and we put out 5 CDs and toured the world and really enjoyed playing and writing music and still making music, so I guess that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a great name for the band, by the way. Where'd you get a name like that?
The Snake Handlers? We were sitting around one afternoon trying to figure out the name of the band, and I had grown up near some folks who, that's the church that they went to, were the church that did snake handling. Not to put down anybody's religious beliefs at all. We were just talking about it and how the only way I could play with the kids who went there was if I went to church with them, and their mom would let me play with them. And so in telling that story, the folks that were sitting around in the room with me said, oh, well, that's a great name for a band. Let's do it. Is it not nice? And we figured out that it was still respectful, so that's the name of the band.
Yeah, I must say that on the west side of the town where I grew up in southern Missouri, they used to have tent revivals, and occasionally the group that came in would engage in that. So it was, we'd sneak under the edge of the tent and watch that. So you had this career in music going along, and there came a point when you had a terrible accident, because that's part of your story. Tell us about that.
That's right. 4.5 years ago, I was on my scooter driving down the road minding my own business, and the driver of the car didn't see me and pulled into the street right where I was. I avoided being hit. I did an evasive maneuver, but my little scooter wheels got stuck in a rut in the road. The scooter went over. The scooter was fine. I went flying over the scooter and landed on my head and woke up in the hospital about 5 hours later with a moderately severe head injury. And so I had the last almost 5 years to at first struggle and now just deal with the side effects from that. The biggest one being memory loss. Yeah.
Memory loss and trouble speaking. And so you turned to, of all things, recipe writing as a form of cognitive therapy. Why recipe writing?
Well, because I started writing. My problem that I was having was I would be in a sentence or I'd be in a conversation with somebody and I'd be moving along in the sentence and then hit a wall with the word that I knew the word. I could picture the word. I just couldn't see the word. The thing with the four legs, you sit on it, you pull it up to the table. What was the word? Chair. It was everyday words that I couldn't access. So in order to avoid being embarrassed all the time and to exercise my brain, I started writing out stories. But then I found out that in writing stories, I was cheating a little bit because I'd try to think of a word and I couldn't think of the word and I'd come up with a word similar enough to the word that was, close enough that it got the meaning across. I'd use a thesaurus. So, both of those were cheating in my book. So I turned to recipe writing because I realized that you can't cheat in recipes. And friends and family for years have been asking me to write down my recipes, and so I took that opportunity to write them down. And really, a carrot is a carrot. Cinnamon is cinnamon. You can't come up with another word that's similar to those. So it took me a lot longer to write the recipes down, but I think it really helped. I exercised my brain.
So Ruby Dee, musician, goes into therapy, which in her form takes the form of this recipe writing. And now all of a sudden, you've got a new thing going here. Now, you had a history as a restaurateur, right?
That's right. That's right. I had owned restaurants for years in Seattle.
As a matter of fact, the Food Network said that your Tango Tapas restaurant and lounge offered one of America's top five desserts of all time. What was that?
I think it was top five top chocolate desserts of all time. It was called the El Diablo, and I wish I could take credit for it, but I had this amazing pastry chef. She invented it. It's a cube of bittersweet chocolate with a little bit of cayenne in the chocolate, served over a bed of burnt meringue with a tequila caramel sauce over the top, cocoa nibs, cocoa powder. I have to keep going on. I think that's it. It's this amazing dessert.
Wow. So you now have arrived at the point where by this circuitous route of therapy plus your restaurant background, and here we are looking at Ruby's Juke Joint Americana Cookbook. Now, I've been in any number of places. There's a show on the Food Network called Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and I've been in a few of those over the years. And the things that you've got in this cookbook, tell me, do they fall under the kind of thing you might find in a truck stop or a diner?
I'd say more of a diner, but also more than that in the backyard at somebody's backyard cookout. This is really home-style cooking. And where I got the idea for the recipes, actually, is some of them are, foundational from my grandmother's and my mother's kitchen. And then, of course, cookouts that we would go to at Neighbors where I grew up. I would get ideas, and then I would go home and I would approximate those recipes as I got older, try to remember how did Nanny make that, how did Grandma make that, and write them out. But then also in my travels around the United States, both as a musician and just as a human being, I've had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of cooking, styles that I maybe wouldn't have run across otherwise. Chowders in the Northeast, and of course all the chilies in the South, and smoked salmon in the Northwest and barbecue all over the country. There's so many different kinds of barbecue and all the different types, you know, Cajun cuisine. There's so many different cultural cuisines that are here that I have fallen in love with and taken a little piece of that home and written up my own versions of those. And that's what you'll find in this book. It's all
some
really
pretty wild recipes
all
in here.
Americana.
Yeah. There's some wild stuff I want to get into in a moment, but you mentioned barbecue, and that's one of the great mysteries to me, is having traveled around the country, and you know, you go to Missouri, or you go to Texas, or you go to North Carolina, wherever you go, people have different ideas about barbecue, and I don't mean a little bit different, I mean wildly different, and I've never understood how all of those things could be barbecue.
Well, you know where barbecue originated?
No, I don't.
The Native Americans. It was here already. It was the people who moved to this country from other countries, you know, whether it's Puritans or whoever, who brought meat with them and the different things that they brought with them to turn it into the barbecue that we have today. But Native Americans originally got a fire going, let it die down a little bit, threw meat on there, and let it cook. That was the original barbecue. That and where the word barbecue comes from is barbecue. Did you know this?
No.
It's French. Barbecue is when you put a stick through a pig or a chicken or whatever from the barb to the queue, the barb being the neck to the queue, which is the back end. Barbecue.
Well, you are just a font of knowledge here. This is great stuff. And I'm looking at some of the stuff that you find in Ruby's Juke Joint Americana Cookbook. There are a lot of cookbooks out there. Not many will have what you have on page 38 here, and I quote, bacon wrapped dates. Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
is that good? I love bacon, and I love dates.
You've never had this before?
I've never had the two together, no.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. If I put bacon in something, my husband will eat it. And he doesn't care for fruit very much. So if I wrap the fruit in bacon and do something with it, he'll eat it and love it. So this is one of those things that I make with him in mind.
What is a Texas martini?
Ah, okay. Well, there's such a thing as a Mexican martini. And the first time I'd had one, I went home and tried to approximate making the same thing. But this is a little different. This is my own concoction. It's a martini, but made with tequila. But it's exactly made like a martini. You use dry vermouth and a little triple sec. Well, you actually mix the martini and the margarita ingredients to make this what I call the Texas martini. So yeah, so there's dry vermouth, some triple sec, an olive, a little olive juice to make it dirty, some lime. It's so good.
And here's one I like here, the dessert on page 142, chocolate bourbon pecan pie. And yes, folks, there's bourbon in this.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite pies, actually, of all time.
Yeah.
Every year there's a Loretta Lynn birthday celebration, and they actually have a pie cookout where ladies are going to get up and sing because there's a whole bunch of us living in Austin who are Loretta fans. They have one band backing us up, and each of us get up and sing a song or two, and we've brought a pie that then gets auctioned off, and there's money that's raised for cancer awareness.
Tell us about your music career now. You've got, of course, the cookbook out, and you've got your history as a restaurateur, but what is Ruby Dee up to and the Snake Handlers as well in terms of, tours? You got the new CD, of course, but what all are you doing?
Well, the last CD that we had come out was actually last year, the last Ruby Dee and the Snake Handlers CD, and that was Grammy nominated. We didn't make the top five. We didn't go to LA and get all fancy dressed up or anything, but we were in the top 135 in the first round before it went up to the top five. So that's we can still say we're Grammy nominated, and that is such a surprise, a pleasant surprise that we get to lug around with us right now. But we're still writing and playing and not touring so much right now because I've been doing so much work on the book. But we do little flyouts. We'll fly out to Green Bay and do a three-day thing at the Oneida up there. We'll fly out to Seattle and do a three-day little mini tour up there. We're getting ready to go to put something together for next year, a tour back in Europe, because we usually do a nice long tour in Europe every year. So that'll be our return to the touring world.
Well, this is pretty fun stuff, I must say. And, Ruby, I want to thank you for sharing this with us. We've enjoyed this immensely.
Oh, good. I hope I made sense. I hope I was awakened
you made,
for you.
You made tons of sense. And I hope everybody out there will check this out. Ruby's Juke Joint Americana Cookbook that I just think is just as slick as all get out. It is from Bando Press, and included in the cookbook itself is a copy of the Ruby's Juke Joint Americana Cookbook CD, which is great stuff. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, and just a point on the CD, it is a variety of different types of Americana music. I have one song on there, but there's a little bit of hillbilly, a little bit of jazz, a little bit of surf, a little bit of rockabilly. There's all kinds of different music on there from some of my favorite Americana musicians today. So it's not just me on there. And you can get the book at rubysjukejoint.com.
rubysjukejoint.com. There you go. Fun lady. And we'll take a quick break on the Bohannon Show. We'll be right back. Well, here we are back on the Jim Bohannon Show. We're glad that you're a part of our program tonight. It's going to be an interesting conversation on the coming Bohannon Show with Congressman Michael Burgess of Texas. He's a backer of Newt Gingrich. And I'll just be curious as to how he approaches the Gingrich candidacy, because, of course, not long ago, he was the presumptive conservative alternative to Mitt Romney. And now, of course, Rick Santorum is the presumptive conservative alternative to Mitt Romney. This is a strange election year, genuinely, seriously strange. I'll look forward to that also. If you're one of those people who loves a good thriller, we have a couple of them for you. We'll chat with Gary Grossman, whose novels, Executive Action and Executive Treason, are now available as e-books. These are a little scary, I mean, just because they're plausible. But we'll talk with Gary Grossman in our second hour on the coming Jim Bohannon Show. We also have former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold going to be joining us in the not-too-distant future. Look at his thoughts. And in particular, I'm curious as to what he sees as any possible liberal alternatives to Barack Obama, since liberals are not that thrilled with Mr. Obama in many cases. In Beaver, Pennsylvania, good news and bad news for Allende Crawford. The good news is congratulations on your new baby. The bad news is sorry that the cops had to bust you on outstanding warrants right there in the delivery room, but... Boy, those things do happen, don't they? Memo to whomever broke into Nick Skulak's home near Colorado Springs. Bet you'll think twice before again breaking into a wildlife center and in the process letting three tigers loose. Just be thankful you didn't wind up for dinner. Three Indian politicians have resigned from a state parliament after being caught watching porn on a phone. All three are members of a morally conservative party, and one is Minister of Women's Affairs. Or maybe that's what they were watching. I don't know. Speaking of problems in that regard, there are others who have similar problems out there. I love the London court clerk who got caught watching porn while he was supposed to be taking care of a rape trial. Europe's caught in a very severe cold wave, which has prompted one French health minister to tweet that the homeless should stay indoors. I did not make that up. He tweeted that the homeless should stay indoors. And Butte, Montana police chased John Hughes at speeds over 100 miles an hour, and when they blew out his tires and approached the car, there was John. No drugs, no booze. Asked why he did it, he replied, "Always wanted to do that." We'll see if he always wanted to do what comes next. Our producer and webmaster is Paul Hill. Our engineer, Bill Pimble. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Network.